Well, you know, we've unpacked a lot of the undercurrents around this BECS, and we have a special guest with us tonight. He's a professor of management and director of the Institute for Sports Management at the University of New Haven. He's also the co-author of College Athletes for Hire, The Evolution and Legacy of the NCAA's Amateur Myth. He's the co-founder of the Drake Group, whose mission is to help faculty and staff defend the academic integrity in the face of a burgeoning college sports industry. He is the author of Counterfeit Amateurs, An Athlete's Journey Through the 60s to the Age of Academic Capitalism. He brings together really in this book both his own compelling story about his own experience as a highly recruited college, a high school athlete who played at Notre Dame and on their national championship team with the legendary coach Eric Parseghian. But he's really, I think, over the past couple years, or past few years, since the 60s, been recognized as a scholar activist that really is really challenging what he calls the academic capitalism of the system under the current NCAA rules. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys, the RSG World, Dr. Alan Sack. Dr. Sack, welcome to our show.
Well, thanks a lot for asking me to be on. I greatly appreciate it.
We were just talking about the BCS championship game. Did you have a chance to watch that at all?
Just now I caught the end. And who was the person you were talking to?
I was talking to Eric Hamilton, who's one of our guests here on one of our co-hosts here on the show, along with Phil, who you know, about the championship game. So we were having a little conversation about that. But you caught the end of the championship game?
Yeah, exactly. And I thought what I just heard him say was he was talking about the long lull between your last game and the fall and when you finally play in your bowl game.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, goodness, last night I've never seen a more pathetic offense in my entire life. And I don't think that, I really don't believe that LSU was that bad. But I was also thinking, God, hell, if you haven't been playing and pushing and really hitting hard and you're kind of just sitting back waiting for this game, you can kind of lose that edge. And I don't know why Alabama didn't lose its edge, but boy, LSU did.
And I think you hit it, losing the edge and having that time, the layoff was kind of incredible. And part of what we're talking about is really what, you know, what this BCS system has done to even the flow of games. Most people don't know or may not know that you played at a high level. You played at Notre Dame in the 60s. What was your experience like as an athlete being recruited? And, you know, compared to what you saw last night, what was your experience, you know, being recruited by Notre Dame and competing in the 60s as an athlete?
All right, before I hit that question, I'll hit it in a second. I did want to mention one other thing about that game last night. Although the offense of LSU was really anemic, I really think you have to hand it to them for their defense hanging in as long as they did. And that relates to my being on the defensive end at Notre Dame. When you're in a game that long, and I don't think I ever was in a game that long, these guys hung in there, and they didn't let them score. They had 5 field goals, and that could have been like 35-0, and it was really 15-0. And then at the end, they finally crumbled, which is understandable because every time it was just one and out for the offense. So I have nothing but kudos and cheers for the defense. It was a great defensive game on both sides. It's just that LSU fell apart on the offense. Notre Dame, fantastic experience. For me, and a real privilege, actually, to play for a team like that. First of all, the caliber of people that I had a chance to play with. Alan Page, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but played for the Minnesota Vikings. He's now the Associate Justice for the Supreme Court in Minnesota, played on the Minnesota Vikings on at least 3 or 4 teams that went to the Super Bowl. Never won. Got a lot of... came close a lot of times. Rocky Blyer, who was who played in Vietnam. I mean, he fought in Vietnam after his career in college. That was back in the late 60s, early 70s, and had part of his leg blown away, and actually came back and played for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And he has quite a few Super Bowl rings. Terry Hanratty, Jim Seymour, Jim Lynch, all my other buddies, I was kind of like a backup defensive end to Alan Page, who was an All-American, and I feel, you know, proud to even have the damn uniform on. So from that point of view, I am very, very happy to have played there. My coach was fantastic, our Parsegian. And what was it like to play there? It doesn't even compare. This year was our 45th reunion of our national championship football team. And we all went back to South Bend. The whole team was there, pep rally, the whole deal. And I do remember it hit me as they dragged us out there in wheelchairs and stuff onto the field. And everybody cheered. And I looked around at the crowd and thinking about the stands, which are much, you know, far more seats than there were when I was there. And I was really reflecting on how much it has changed. We had no freshman football when I played at Notre Dame, and most of the players did want to play. They wanted to play as freshmen, and you could be a Phi Beta Kappa. I mean, you could have a 4.0 average. You could have gone to Oxford, you know, and been a Rhodes Scholar. You stood and played as a freshman, so which drove home the point. They didn't have to call us student athletes. They didn't really use that term that much, but we knew we were students because they wouldn't let us play, and they wouldn't let us play because they wanted us to make an adjustment to college. And here's one, I don't know if you know this or not, but we won the national championship by playing Michigan State, but it was a tie, but we had one more game left, so we played Southern Cal and really slaughtered them, I guess, 51-0. The point was that we won the national championship without going to a bowl game, because in 1966-67, Notre Dame and there were other schools as well who simply did not believe that it was in the academic interest of the athletes to go to a bowl game, because we had final exams and we had things we had to take care of toward the end of that semester, the first semester. And such a notion is absolutely inconceivable, you know, in the minds of the average American today. You guys are sitting there talking about playoffs. Man, when I was playing, the team wanted to go to a bowl game. They just wouldn't let us go to a bowl game because, sports were something that you did to enhance your total education. It didn't overwhelm your education, and I think that's really an important point. And the final thing I want to mention, and this will lead in, I hope, in the next 15 minutes, 20, whatever we're talking, the notion that when I was recruited in high school, I was recruited by, I'd say, approximately 100 different schools, and with all kinds of scholarship offers, and teams, coaches from University of Pittsburgh or Notre Dame and others who had come to my house, you know the experience. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that whole thing in your families or yourselves. You are highly recruited. But when they came to my house, they were able to say that to my mom and dad, Mr. and Mrs. Sack, that if your son comes to our school, your son is there for 4 years. And even if he turns out to be a recruiting mistake, and we know he's not going to be, we think he's going to be a Heisman Trophy winner. But even if he ends up not being as good as you thought, he still has his scholarship at Notre Dame, at Pitt, at Duke, wherever they were from when they were recruiting me. And I thought that was, my parents thought that was really a great thing, because Notre Dame was saying that they were committed to me as a student and as a human being, and not as a commodity that could be traded from one school to another, or run off, or fired, so to speak, or take your scholarship away if you're injured. And I was guaranteed my education if I were injured as well. And so, again, to put it in context, and you asked me about my Notre Dame experience, I truly do feel privileged to have played at a time when I think the priorities, although, come on, there was cheating back then too, you know, all over the place. But they did still care about us. And why shouldn't today's college athletes have those same kinds of privileges? Why can't the modern-day kid who goes to a big-time school also, and I know the NCAA is making some efforts to go back in that direction, but why can't they have the kind of educational experience that I had in general? So that's it. I just wanted to make that point about Notre Dame and the comparison.
I love that. And Alan, and part of that, in talking about the fact that you won a national championship and didn't win a bowl game, and you mentioned the Michigan State game, which is referred to as the first mega game of modern television era. Can you talk about that? The three folks who are on the air with you, you know, we weren't alive during that time. We didn't see that. but it really launched kind of a new era between television and college sports. Can you talk a little bit about that game?
Yeah, you make a very good point, by the way, that whole idea of that 1966 game. That was, we were just on the cusp in big-time college sports of moving into the television era. And some people have written about that game and said that may have been symbolic of the crossing the line. The game was televised in Vietnam to our troops. So obviously telecommunications had become far more sophisticated than ever. You can broadcast all over the place. Supposedly it had the highest Nielsen rating or the television rating of any college football game ever at that point in time. So what does that mean? People who are watching that, who have media savvy, people in the networks and the sponsors and so forth, that are saying, my God, all those people are watching that one game. It's almost like a Super Bowl of that area. You know, they're all watching this one game. Man, could we sell some products if we get ourselves associated with that? And so people were not naive. They knew that that kind of connection was there between sports and commodification and commercialism. But that game drove home how much progress had been made in terms of the television era and the idea of being able to penetrate new markets by extending your reach through your athletic program at the big-time level so that you could reach into Dallas, you could reach into New York City, you could actually have conferences that, and they start making decisions in terms of market share more so than anything that has to do with the students, I mean the athletes, student interests. So, yeah, that was a tie. It's very controversial. People have been beating up on my coach, who's now about 86 years old, Arif Farsesian. He never got over that in the final minutes of that game, and some of your older listeners right now will recall it. Toward the end of that game, there was no tiebreaker back then, and it was 10-10. The wind was blowing in our face. I'm going to give you a justification here, and people are going to say, hey, that's bullshit. But it was, and our starting quarterback had just been injured, Terry Hanratty, so I had a backup quarterback in there, Coley O'Brien. And this all happened, and our starting center, George Gedeke, was injured, and he was in the game. There's 2 minutes left in the game. Now you got your backup center, you got your backup quarterback, and our All-American running back, Nick Eddy, I'm not making this up, he's getting off the train in Lansing, Michigan before the game, and he already had a slight injury in his shoulder, but he fell against the side. I don't know if they're on a train, I don't know if they still have him, but an iron handle you could hold as you're balancing yourself to get down the steps. And he tripped and slid on the step, and it's unbelievable. He fell right into that. I was in back of my soul, fall right into that thing and hit his shoulder, so he didn't play in that game either. So picture this, very windy. It's a tie game. You've got the ball at your own 30-yard line. There's now a minute and a half left in the game, and you've got all these kind of rookies in your backfield. The worst thing could happen to you is you're going to fumble, you're going to screw up, you're going to throw an interception, and they have a guy named Bob Apiza or something, I've forgotten the exact name, but he was fantastic, one of the first guys to kick with the soccer style. People used to do the extra points with their toe, and now he was and barefoot. Fantastic. So Ara, to kind of get right to the point, did he just go, did he tie one for the Gipper? That's what I always say about him. He tied one for the Gipper instead of winning one for the Gipper. And he did keep the ball on the ground for a couple of plays, all right, and he didn't really go for it with a bomb. He was holding off on that until maybe 30 seconds left. 20 seconds left, so he could throw a long pass, get into the field goal range, and kick the field goal and win the game. But it didn't go that way. Ran the ball 3 times, off tackle. People started to boo. They were booing in the stands, I remember very clearly. And then he tried to throw the long pass, and Coley O'Brien was sacked. The quarterback was sacked, and it ended. And there wasn't a sound. There wasn't a sound in the stadium in the supposed game of the century. People were stunned that it was a tie. It ends in a tie. You couldn't cheer. You couldn't cry. Some people did. Walked over and shook hands with the other guys from Michigan State, and they were pissed off, and we were pissed off, and now who's going to be national champion? And they made us national champion. So if you want to see the seeds of much that you see today about the issue of playoffs, I mean, you could see a little kernel of that. People want to know who's winning, who's the best team in the country, and they don't want the Associated Press
playoffs.
To be the ones.
What are you talking about? Playoffs? Are you kidding me?
That's the point. That's the point. We wanted the Associated Press gave it to us. And to this day, you know, I'll be honest with you, Michigan State has just as much of a claim as anybody else.
What's interesting about what you talk about is so we start to see this kernel going on. But it's also, I mean, kind of the backdrop for this is kind of the unrest that happened in the 60s. And I know in your book you talk about kind of the uprising and the unrest in the 60s and the impact of that on sports. Can you talk about, in the midst of that, you also had on your campuses all this activity in which athletes were involved in some of this. What impact did that unrest of the 60s begin to have on kind of changing the landscape of college sports?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And if you go to that 10-10 tie, Michigan State, that's related to what you're talking about in the sense that at Notre Dame in 1966, we had one black football player on the team. One. His name was Alan Page, and I think he's one of the finest, arguably one of the finest football players ever to play in the pros even, you know, all pro Alan Page. But we played Michigan State, and honest to God, Michigan State had just about it wasn't a totally black starting team, but it was close to it. Bubba Smith and a lot of others, Mike Webster. And so Michigan State was already into the recruitment of black athletes, and some other schools, maybe Syracuse and some others, were starting to do that, and they were becoming, they were winning. Okay, so already you started to have more of an influx of the black athletes into college sports. However, in the Southeast Conference in 1971, and this is hard to believe, maybe people know this, but in 1971 there was not one black football player in the Southeast Conference, not one. And it was simply just a segregated system. And by 1971, 73, 74, and I think it's because of the television, all of a sudden the Bear Bryants of the world and the others and from the South start to realize, hey, if we're going to win, we better get these black athletes in here. So you see a shift. Now, to get directly to your point, 1968, most tumultuous year of my younger life. You know, President Kennedy's assassinated, and Martin Luther King, not Kennedy, that's earlier on, but Martin Luther King was assassinated, and there we had the in Vietnam War, there was the Tet Offensive. There were a lot of things that happened in that year, assassination of Bobby Kennedy, not Teddy Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and so other things were happening. And one of the other things that many people don't realize even today is 1968 was also the Mexico City Olympics. And the Mexico City Olympics are famous because of John Carlos and Tommy Smith walking out there onto the stand for the medal ceremony and standing and putting their hands in the air with the black glove salute. And This is amazing. I teach, you know, in a college university, and in the dormitories, you will still see that you'll see that poster on the walls in kids' rooms. And I ask the kids in my class, some of whom actually had that poster, what that represents. They don't know. they think it's a cool picture of these two guys out there with a black guys with their hand up in a black salute for black power. But they really don't know what black power was all about. But what it really meant was these athletes were part of an attempted boycott of the 1968 Olympics that was led by Harry Edwards, San Jose University professor. And Harry was really trying to organize a worldwide boycott by people of color of the Olympics, especially in the United States. And the argument is this. I don't know if the listeners want to buy into this, but they were saying, these kids were saying, why should we be winning medals for the United States and really bringing all this prestige to the United States? And this is true even back to the 1936 Olympics with Jesse Owens. Jesse Owens comes back, under these guys, John Carlos and Tommy Smith, try to go to a hotel, and they don't let him stay there because they're black. They go home in their cities in the southern states and even in the northern states, and they're treated like second-class citizens. Black guys coming home from Vietnam, giving their lives for this country, who don't have equal opportunity in any aspect of life in America. And so here is this. You can sell products through sports, right, as we talked about earlier, but you can sell politics through sports, too. And you know a lot of people are watching, so they walked out there. And they really did give up their medals. and the other acclaim they could have had. And they were, after they protested, they were let out of the Olympics, and they were kicked out of the Olympics. And they really generated, the response to that was that on college campuses throughout the United States, black athletes started protesting. And in 1969, 70, 71, real outbreaks of revolt of the black athlete is what Harry Edwards' book is actually called. And it has substantial consequences for the integration of athletes on athletic teams in college campuses, as well as on the college campuses in general. No doubt about that. Where Syracuse University, I'll give you this one example, Syracuse University in 1971, I think they might have had 9 players who simply refused to play until, it was a Schwarzwalder, I guess, Ben Schwarzwalder was their coach. And on the coaching staff, it was common to call a black athlete, "Boy, hey boy, get over here." They had a predominantly black team at Syracuse at that time, and there were no black cheerleaders, no women cheerleaders, no men cheerleaders that were black. My students just don't believe this stuff because they can't believe it could possibly be like that or it could have been like that, but it was like that. Black athletes and white athletes were segregated in their housing. You know, the football players. Can you imagine? Black and white athletes were not allowed to live together. So these 9 athletes said, until these things are fixed, we're not going to play. And so they boycotted the games. And they lost their scholarships, and they never did get back. Most of them never got back to playing or ever getting a letter anywhere in football until, I guess, 2006. The provost at Syracuse University invited them back. This is really a touching thing. They were called the Syracuse 9 or whatever, and these guys some of them never got degrees either. And they were invited back, and they got their letter jackets, honorary letter jackets, finally in this game against, I can't remember who they played in the Big East, but that happened. So I think what this shows, and it really, I think, proves in many ways, the University of Louisville is who it was. I think what it shows is that when athletes band together, as they did then, and the black athletes did it, and there were some white athletes too at Notre Dame who joined in these kind of boycotts on behalf of civil rights and even the war in Vietnam. But when athletes and on our campuses pull together and join together, they can make tremendous. That may be one of the biggest reforms in college sports ever. And it was really a consequence of the black athletes who had really spearheaded this movement to say, wait a minute, we're opening up these universities to people of color. And so I think people don't give that enough emphasis. I believe that was a major turning point. And it was done not by sitting there and talking it out in bureaucratic kind of meetings with the NCAA and just year after year hearing the same old, same old. They said, hey, we're not going to play. And that really brought some change. But as with all changes, a couple of those athletes got thrown under the bus. And it took many, many years to come back. And they never really had their college athletic careers, but they felt on principle that was really important.
When you think about, coming out of that in terms of what things actually laid the groundwork for professionalism in college sports, what would you say are the one or two kinds of events that kind of laid the groundwork for what you would say is professionalism of college sports?
Well, obviously the coaches weren't particularly happy about this stuff, athletes boycotting, walking away and saying we're not going to play. 1967, a rule was passed, not a coincidence. A rule was passed. It was called the Fraudulent Misrepresentation Rule. And what that rule said was that if you voluntarily withdraw from sports or if you defy your coach, they can take away your scholarship immediately. Because at that time, and when I played at Notre Dame, I had that 4-year scholarship I told you about that was guaranteed. 1967, they said, it's not guaranteed anymore. If you are not going to go along with what your coach says, or if you're going to cause trouble, or if you're going to boycott in some way or other and be involved in politics, we can take away your scholarship. And if anybody out there is in the NCAA or is interested in this stuff, just go back to your NCAA manual, and you will find that the fraudulent misrepresentation rule is still there. And that's when it came into existence. Another couple of years went by. And what the fraudulent misrepresentation rule allowed you to do was get rid of a kid who, you know, was really not being following rules, or if he just walked away. And many people would say, you can see where that there may be some justice to that. You have an athletic scholarship, and you just go out there and kind of take a nap under the goalpost during practice. You know, I mean, you should probably don't deserve. I don't know, but that's what that did. But you still couldn't get rid of a kid who was a recruiting mistake, Deadwood. All right. And you still couldn't really just take that scholarship away because they weren't playing well enough or because they were injured. 1973 is what my book, Counterfeit Amateurs, is all about. And one reviewer, I guess, just missed the entire point, had no idea what the hell I was talking about. That's what the book's about. My basic criticism is this 1973 rule, which said that if the player does not really perform to the coach's expectations and follow every rule and every directive, and if they, even if they're injured, that you can take away their scholarship. And my argument is that that transformed these athletes. It was a fairly slow transformation from being kind of amateurs before 1956, when it was need-based financial aid, into kind of professionals when they started giving athletic scholarships. But finally, in 1973, literally, and here's where many of your listeners, and I go for this argument all the time, I argue literally they turned into employees. There's an offer, there's an acceptance, there's a consideration, it's a contract. So the one-year renewal scholarship says that we have a contractual relationship and you're going to play the way I want you to play, and you're going to do what I want you to do. I'm taking away your room, board, tuition, and fees. I'm going to fire you. Okay? That's an employment relationship, and if it is, and here's the rest of my book, is if you turn these kids into employees, you have no right to limit the amount of compensation that they get. This is free. You guys want to play free enterprise? You know, if the university can go out there and sell its product to the highest bidder, you know, if every person on campus who can write a business plan can go out there and make money from college sports, you're going to treat these kids like criminals for, you know, taking a hamburger from an alumnus? This is bullshit. So my book is really saying here that when you transform these kids into professional athletes, which they did in 1973, and I continue to argue it, and if the law doesn't yet accept that, certainly the objective conditions of what an athlete faces today are like employment. It's hard to separate them from employment. You are controlled from the time you get up to the time you go to bed. There is no other merit award winner on campus. The guy who plays the violin, or a woman who plays the violin, or whomever, in the orchestra on campus does not go through what the big-time college athlete does in terms of having their life controlled, and they're controlled because they can, in fact, be fired if they don't go along with the program. And therefore, hey, they should get workers' compensation if they go to court after that. They should be able to ask for certain kind of benefits and so on and so forth. And if you want to expand on that discussion, I'd be glad to. But I think that was laying the foundation. If you're going to build an industry, and that's what it is, big-time college sports, multi-million-dollar industry, you can't do that with amateurs, honestly. You have to have kids. You have to have a pliable and controllable workforce. And the way you got that workforce is by introducing the one-year renewable scholarship, because now you have a way of firing and hiring and controlling and getting what you really want to win national championships.
This is great. We're with Alan Sack, author of Counterfeit Amateurs. I have my co-host here that would love to ask some questions. We're going to push it over to Phil. Phil, I know you have some questions you'd like to talk to Alan about. Phil, why don't you go ahead and ask your question?
Absolutely. So while I was reading your book, one of the things that stuck out to me, Dr. Sack, is you talked about in 1989 you did a survey that you conducted with the support of the NFL Players Association. Can you talk a little bit about that survey and some of your findings that you talked about in your book?
Well, first of all, 1989, Ed Garvey was the director of the National Football League Players Association. And in the 1980s, I had been involved in an organization called the Center for Athletes' Rights and Education. And we were trying to get the kind of rights that I was just talking about, the right for athletes to have the same kind of benefits that workers have, right? So I got to know the people at the NFL Players Association quite well, Gene Upshaw and the whole crew. Ed Garvey was the director. There's a different kind of mood down there then, I sense, than today. I mean, there was still some of that activism left over from the 70s and 80s, and the athletes were still thinking in terms of athletes' rights rather than simply my right to make $1 billion no matter what. You know, it was kind of a feeling of, hey, there's a fairness issue involved here. We want a percentage of the gross. We're going to go on strike. We're going to organize. I got involved with that whole thing and knew the people there, and I said, geez, I was asked to go to California, I guess, to Stanford University, or a think tank just outside of Stanford, and the NCAA and some other people were trying to put together a survey of college athletes to examine a wide variety of issues around education and big-time college sports. And I went out there and I said, geez, you know one of the biggest issues regarding education here? The fact that these athletes have been turned into employees, and therefore they're not able to really spend the time getting the education that they were promised, that they have to take their orders, so to speak, from the coach. Their priority is trying out for them, keeping my scholarship for the next year. I can't be worried about how I'm doing in the classroom except for eligibility. So I thought that was a key issue. The people from, like, NCAA backgrounds and stuff who were in this group meeting kind of thought I was nuts or something, making that point, and they refused. I said, no, we should put some questions in this questionnaire about the day-to-day living conditions of being a college athlete. We should ask them, what is their attitude toward the athletic scholarship? Does it really cover their full needs? Should college athletes be able to have compensation beyond what the current NCAA rules allow? And one that really knocked them out, I said, why don't we put in there and ask them if they've ever taken money under the table or if they've ever really been in that situation. By the way, I think the fact that athletes take money under the table and are treated like criminals, I think that is a real crime in itself, that they deserve what they get and they shouldn't be treated like prostitutes or something for getting the kind of compensation that they really deserve. Anyway, they refused to include my questions. They went ahead with the survey. It was okay, and there were some interesting findings from it. But I said, I'm going to do my own, damn it. So I got a hold of my friends at the NFLPA. I asked them if I could send out my own survey. And it was really cool. They said, yeah. And they allowed me to use their mailing. You know, I didn't have access to the names, but I sent them my survey, and I put them all in envelopes and stuff, very primitive. We didn't have Survey Monkey and stuff like that like they have today, computers. This was like in individual envelopes I sent out these surveys. And they sent them out to about over 2,000 NFL ballplayers and former NFL ballplayers, and I was just dumbfounded that it actually got off the ground, you know. They sent it out. And I think I went off skiing for spring break or something. I had an opportunity to go with my sons. Came back, and my God, I went to my mailbox, and the mailbox was like overflowing. I couldn't believe these guys actually sent these things back.
Yeah.
And if my mailbox was full, and they said, no, wait a minute, come on back here. Not only was my mailbox full, but they had boxes full of these envelopes coming back from NFL ballplayers. 1,200 or so actually responded. And what I found was that, like, 70% of these guys saw nothing whatsoever wrong with taking money that went beyond what the NCAA really allows. I found that in the Southwest Conference that about, I think it was probably 50 or 60% of the athletes admitted having taken money under the table. In the Southwest,
wow.
In the Southwest Conference, which this is back in 1989 now we're talking about, right? In the Southwest Conference, which doesn't exist anymore. But they were just a renegade kind of outfit out there. And
SMU.
SMU. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. SMU. That whole crew. The governor's involved giving money to the ballplayers, right? And they see nothing wrong with it. Honest, to this day, they still don't see anything wrong with it. I actually get talks down in the South sometimes, and they agree with me down in Alabama that the athlete should be paid. But anyway, this one guy from, I don't know where he was from, I know he's from the Southwest Conference. He said he had part in interest in an oil well for going for one tool or other. So I was blown away. Of course, the NCAA and this guy named is it Swofford is still the commissioner of the Southeast Conference, I think. But I think one of the same guys is in place. But at that time, he says, this is crazy, you know. this is a bad sample. It's poor research. Ask the wrong guys. You want to ask the football, the best football players, and that's only a small group. The rest of them who don't go into the pros would not answer the same way. But regardless, I did get many, many athletes who were very cynical. And to tell you the truth, the most cynical were the African-American athletes. And I was asked by the New York Times, why was it that the African-American athletes were more likely to say they felt that the rules should, that you should be allowed to have greater benefits than the rules allow than did the white athletes? And my answer was simple, and I said that I think African-Americans historically are more familiar with rule systems and legal systems that give them very little for the kind of work that they put into an effort. For God's sake, go back to slavery, and then after slavery, and even until today, you still have these differentials between African Americans and others, and things have improved dramatically in many, many ways. But certainly in the 60s, it was still the case that if you're African American, and in the 70s and even in the 80s, you were not going to be making as much money as a white person in the same job. So what I said, the cynicism that I found among these athletes, professional athletes, about these issues broken down by race, had to do with the history of inequality in America. And so that was that study, and I've been trying like crazy to do it again, right? I've been trying. I went down to Washington with my wife on a little vacation, and I drove her crazy. I said, I'm going to go over to the NFLP. I'm walking right in there. I'm going to talk to this, what's his name, the new guy at the NFLP.
Demar Smith.
What's it again?
Demar Smith.
Yeah. D. Smith, right? D. Smith. And I used to walk in there all the time, and it was kind of an informal thing. Today, things are so tough. It's like you're trying to break into prison. You know, I mean, I come to the door, security guy, I leave a note, I leave a copy of my questionnaire, I call D. Smith's office, I call his assistant for a whole year, maybe even 2 years. Oh, thank God, I'm persistent sometimes. I still want to do that study today, and I want to ask some of those same questions today. And I think it would be overwhelmingly in favor of extending the scholarship, at least to the full cost of education, if not simply saying that these athletes should be allowed to engage in the same entrepreneurial and business activities as their celebrity coaches. I see no reason why they should not be able to.
That's good stuff. We're with Alan Sack, author of Counterfeit Amateurs. I know, Eric, I know you have a question for Dr. Sack. I'll let you ask the question here.
Yeah, Dr. Sack, I did have a chance to take a look at some of your interviews that you've done, and one in particular you state that it's intellectually dishonest to call collegiate athletes amateurs, and you talk about a reform is needed. So my question to you is, can you discuss your reform plan and what will it really take to make that reform plan a reality?
Well, I go in two directions on this, and I've been caught in this bind for many years, for even maybe even decades. When I go onto a talk show, the first question I often get is, should college athletes be paid? All right, that one drives me nuts because it's a leading question, because it presupposes that they're not already paid. And let me try that one again. They say, should college athletes be paid? As soon as I say, yeah, they should be, oh, man, you're attacking amateurs. What's the matter with you? You know, and you're some kind of a deviant. Because you can't win by answering that question. So my response is usually, wait a minute, hold it. Let's reframe that question. The college athletes, as we all know, are already being paid. They're being paid room, board, tuition, and fees. That can amount to as much as $40,000 to $50,000 a year. And that disappears when you walk off the field and say, I'm not playing anymore. That disappears when the coach decides that you're not playing well enough. That's employment. That is pay. That is objectively pay. And I will die arguing that point, even with some of my best friends who argue with me about this. So we're talking about this payment issue and how to change it. Right. So that's one part of me says they should be paid now. Another part of me says, you know, I wish they had never really given athletic scholarships to begin with and maybe stuck with need-based financial aid for everybody. Need-based financial aid for everybody. And this complicate things a bit, but Walter Byers, the former executive director of the NCAA, had a proposal back in 1995 when he finally discovered the truth after many years of not thinking this. He changed and he wrote a very critical book of the NCAA, which he had been the leader of for decades. And he was arguing that you should have need-based, think about this one, give need-based financial aid to all athletes, that is, based on your family background and how much they can contribute, but allow them to make as much money as they want on the side from different kinds of sponsorship deals or speaking engagements or whatever other their coaches are doing. Then, if these are the good athletes would be the ones who would get this, they could keep that money, and the university's not paying them. It's the outside interests that are paying them, just like they're paying the coach. And it has no consequence whatsoever for Title IX because you're not taking money from the university, and the women are still getting their share of the revenue. And so Walter Byers suggested, let them get the money that way. And this is really genius, he says. And when they finally make so much money that it's as much as they're getting in need-based aid, you cut off their need-based aid because the guys are paying for their own educations by, you know, working outside. Well, that's what Walter Byers is, one of his suggestions, which I thought was kind of unique. My feeling is right now, in all honesty, I don't believe that, and I have a friend, Ramogi Huma, who probably disagrees with me on this one, but I don't think the universities right now have enough money to pay salaries to big-time college athletes. The money that comes in on the backs of these big-time college athletes in football and basketball, right now within an athletic department, is spread around to the non-revenue-producing sports and to the women's sports and so forth. So when you get done doing that, there are very few, and this is corroborated by tons of data, very few big-time college athletic programs in the football bowl subdivision are actually making a profit after the money from football and basketball are spread around. All right, so there's really not money there for salaries in the end. But there's no reason why the athletes could not go out and do it like in the Olympic model, and that is be able to make money on the side. I believe that they should be able to do that, and they should be able to go to court to say that it's an antitrust violation for them not to be able to do that. So that's one side of me in terms of saying how you could compensate the athletes in a fair and equitable way. And immorally, there's nothing unethical or immoral about that because you are not violating amateurism because they're not amateurs to begin with. And the other direction to go is to maybe go back to where the NCAA is trying to go right now. You know, say, all right, let's back away from the one-year renewable scholarship. In part, maybe these new guys in the NCAA, who's the new president, the new president of the NCAA, man, blank on his name, Emmert or something, I guess. He's trying to move. Honest to God, I was just before the Penn State crisis, I was totally blown away that the NCAA was actually offering and suggesting that they go back to multi-year scholarships so that you could get your four-year scholarships just like I got at Notre Dame. That really caught my attention, and I was thinking, my God, although many people saw that as a small, maybe symbolic, and maybe just not very significant change. I saw it as radical. They were suggesting, let's go back a bit. Let's go back to where we were when Alan Sack was playing football at Notre Dame, where we had four-year scholarships. So part of me thinks that might be a good way to go, too, so I'm caught in the middle. But if they don't make any change right now, the athletes are going to organize, and the athletes are going to get the court, and they're going to win one of these court cases, and they're going to get paid, and they're going to become employees. And there will be no line of demarcation between professional and college sports. There's very little right now, and whatever little bit there is almost gone. And they'll be the same product. And I don't think I would want that, to tell you the truth, but that's the reality.
Well, Dr. Sack, you really hit a good point there. You have some folks like Ed O'Bannon, who is challenging because NCAA continues to use his likeness and other athletes' likeness as a way of generating revenue. Along with O'Bannon and some of the other, what are some of the movements that are coming about from athletes that you can share with our listeners?
Well, the O'Bannon case is a landmark case. Sonny Vaccaro is heavily involved there, and Sonny, he's a friend. He is really passionate about this. He was the person who started basketball leagues for Nike. if you remember that name. But he is very much in the back of the players on this, and Oscar Robinson signed on to it as a friend of that lawsuit. And O'Bannon, believe it or not, is you guys correct me on the facts on this, but my rough idea is here's that O'Bannon who played for UCLA, did he?
Yeah, he played for UCLA, dominant player on their national championship team. Phil, I'll let you fill in on that one.
And then he went off on the NBA, right?
Yeah,
he was.
Played with New Jersey for a little bit.
So he had a distinguished career, and now he, I don't know if he may be in his 50s. Is that possible, or 40s?
I would say he's in his late 30s, early 40s.
All right. So he's in his. So he has kids. He walks into a toy store, and they're selling games that he's in those games. You know? And who's getting the licensing fees from that? The NCAA is getting the licensing fees from that. But it's his image and it's him who's in that game, and he has to go and buy it himself, and he doesn't get a cut of that. I have not met, and I'm being honest with you. I've argued with a lot of people, and I've seen it, you know, very, I've always been seen as, kind of radical on these things. But even with this issue, I haven't met any person yet who disagreed when I said, don't you think those athletes who making all that money through those games and through those licensing agreements, don't you think when they get out of college, they should be getting a cut of the money that they are that's being generated by the use of their images and by the use of their names and numbers and so on and so forth, to the person, they say, that is outrageous. Those athletes certainly do. Now, people will disagree if I said that while they're still in college, they should be getting a cut of that revenue. I think they should, but most people would say, no, not when they're in college because they're amateurs. That's really crazy, this notion of amateurism. By the way, let me, before you guys kick me off the air, which you probably should at some point, but I have to mention on this NCAA amateurism thing. In 1906, when the NCAA was founded, they made it perfectly clear, and you can find it in the first NCAA meeting minutes and the manual that they had then, back in 1906, and I have it in my own notes here somewhere. It says clearly that any financial inducement that is used to recruit an athlete, any inducements whatsoever, make a kid not an amateur anymore. All right. Whether that's given from someone outside the university or whether it's given inside the university or whether it's given by the financial aid office, it does not matter. If you give an inducement to a player who's in high school or in a prep school to come to your school because of athletics, you are no longer an amateur. So that's the NCAA's original notion of amateurism and their original definition of amateur, and it still exists if you look at the NCAA manual. Amateurism is an avocation, meaning, look it up in Webster's Dictionary. It says it is a diversion. Did you watch those guys last night playing that game? Are they engaged in a diversion? Is this just something they do in their spare time because they think it's kind of a kick and it's a way to get a little bit of leisure activity during an extracurricular activity? That is absurd. And I even talked to Miles Brand, the former president of the NCAA. He agreed with me on the phone anyway. You know, he couldn't say it openly, but he did agree. He said, yeah, it's about time we should scrap this concept of amateurism. So that is another basis of my book, that really it's intellectually dishonest to call young men and women who are out there on one-year athletic scholarships especially and whose lives are being controlled like this and who are now skilled specialists who are really specializing in mass commercial entertainment to generate millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars actually, for the universities. To call them amateurs is really absurd, and it is, I find it, intellectually dishonest, and I find it immoral to do so. They should, whatever they do, they should scrap that term amateur and come up with a collegiate model or whatever you want to call it, but it's not amateurism in any sense.
Well, before we let you go, I know you were looking to hang with us for a little bit and connect with us. We would like to know a little bit about the Drake Group that you co-founded and to give us a little sense of what that's all about. So folks who are listening might want to go and see what you're doing as part of the Drake Group. And can you explain a little bit about the mission of the Drake Group and what that's all about?
Yeah, this comes to bear on my split personality on these issues, which I kind of talk about as we went along, that I go in two ways on this thing. By joining the Drake Group, I would have to voluntarily, and by being the president, which I will become, you know, this spring, I will have to put aside my arguments about paying the athletes and my arguments about, you know, increasing the kind of compensation they get. It's still in my head, and I still believe it's true, but what the Drake Group is going to have to focus itself on is at the academic integrity side of things primarily, and look at the faculty themselves and say that we have a responsibility to the athletes and to students to ensure that they get an adequate education. And so the real thrust of things here is to lobby for legislation with the NCAA that would really allow the athletes to be an integral part of the student body. We really believe that there should be we believe strongly in four-year scholarships, which were like the one I had when I was at Notre Dame. And we actually started making progress in pushing that direction under this new president until the Penn State thing occurred and kind of just wiped that all away. I would love to see that the athletes in the same counseling centers as non-athletes. I don't think there should be a separation there. I think the athletes, black and white, and big time and small time, should be part of the whole environment of the university. They should be doing things with and being integrated into other extracurricular activities besides sports. Right now, they tend to be isolated on the periphery of academic life and of social life. They hang out together. That's okay, but you don't go to college to do that. You go to college to expand your horizons, to be involved with other people from wide varieties of backgrounds, from Asia, from Latin America, from other parts of the United States, people who are athletes, non-athletes, people who are scientists, people who are involved in literature. You go there to broaden your lives. And so the Drake Group is really, really committed to trying to make it possible for the athletes to play their sport, to love their sport, but not to be overwhelmed by it to the point that the education becomes like a distraction and maybe just a point of annoyance. Sometimes they, you know, the athletes say, this is just something I have to do to get through because I want to play pro ball. We'd like to see that change in some way, because we truly believe at the bottom, and from a racial point of view, coming in with regard to black athletes are at the very center of this, is that I believe with along with my friend Alan Page and with, my God, the famous tennis player, who was the very famous black, Arthur Ashe.
Arthur Ashe.
Yeah, Arthur Ashe took the position, I believe, 100%. He said that sports has played enough of a role. This is controversial, maybe even with you black guys who are on your show, but that sports has played an incredible role in the life of African Americans, and it's been very positive in certain ways. But perhaps now it's getting to a negative point, where a young 8-year-old is thinking about the future, but thinks of that future and being like Michael Jordan rather than being like Obama. And I would prefer, and our group would really prefer, that these young black kids identify and try to be the president of the United States rather than being the star in the NBA. And the reason for that is because if you try to be a star in the NBA, you develop certain very specialized skills which are not necessarily generalizable to other areas of life that you need to really survive and prosper in a global economy. Now, you may not get to be Michael Jordan, and most likely you're not going to. And what do you have? You got a lot of athletic skills. Wonderful, but they're not very transferable to the technological and other demands of our society. Spend your time as a young black kid trying to be Obama. You're probably not going to become president. But damn it. Along the way, trying to be Obama, you're going to learn how to read, you're going to learn about history, you're going to learn about political science, you're going to take courses in a wide variety of ways, introducing you to technology and all the things that you need to be a competent administrator and a manager and a president. And you don't get to be the president? Fine, but you have this solid education. And I dream about a world where blacks will not be overrepresented on the athletic teams, where I won't sit down and watch a basketball game or a football game like I did last night and see this predominance of black athletes out there. Those guys are smart. Those guys they have to be smart. You can't play football today and be dumb. You cannot. But they're not as broadly educated as I think they should be, because they've gotten into this real rat race of, I want to be a professional athlete. And forgive me if I make people mad with that one, but I believe that we're not asking enough of the universities to broaden the educational experiences of African Americans so they can all be Obamas. And that would be
well. I will say that as someone who works with college athletes, have met with parents. When I open up my talk, I often ask them, you know, if they know that Shaquille O'Neal has an MBA and he's working on a doctorate, as a way of shifting and understanding what the possibilities are. And so the point that you're making about the Drake Group, we'd love to have you come back and talk about it, because that's in the heart of what we, how do we have more Alan Pages of the world? How do we have more Myron Rose, who is a Rose Scholar? How do we have more of those student stories being more of the narrative of college sports, as well as the Honey Badger? So we have Alan Sack, author of Counterfeit Amateurs. It's been great to have you on the show. We're going to segment into a funky editorial, but we'd love to have you on the show. I know you want to talk about Penn State, and we will talk about a funky editorial if you can stick with us,
sure.
If that works for you in your schedule. But we'll be moving into our the funky editorial brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions. Here we go.
Fellas, the one thing we need to say, yes, can we say it, y'all? Yes, Melvin, right. Jimmy, yes. Coleman, Ryan, say it.
Yes.
Everybody want to get funky one more time.
We want the funk. Give us the funk. Ow.
Well, our funky editorial for today is about the Penn State hire of Jim O'Brien and the reaction from the alumni, particularly the former players who are, I believe, a part of the Letter Club, who had a really weird response to him. And one of the things we want to talk about is whether or not they're justified in their response, particularly about, you know, when we see what recently happened at Michigan with Rich Rodriguez in terms of we need a Michigan man, we need a Penn State man. What is that all about? In terms of that, and so that's going to be a topic of our funky editorial. I'll toss it out there. Maybe we'll start with Phil to kind of have a little reaction to this, and then we'd love to go to Dr. Sack real quick to have his reaction to Penn State. So, Phil, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think this is very interesting because, like you mentioned, there's been a huge backlash from the Penn State family for not selecting a quote-unquote Penn State guy. And I'm not surprised by this, okay? You know, the players, the current student-athletes there, they wanted the guy, I can't think of his name, the guy that stepped in and was the interim coach, you know, to get the full-time job. But I think from a perception management standpoint, Penn State had to separate themselves from Sandusky, which means they had to separate themselves from Paterno. And hiring any Penn State man or guy, 99 times out of 100, they're going to have a strong allegiance and a connection with Paterno. So I think from a perception management standpoint, I agree with Penn State going outside of the Penn State family to bring in O'Brien. I'm not so sure that he's the right guy, but quite honestly, I think the pool that they had to select from was going to be very thin. Because nobody wants to be the guy after the guy in terms of being paternal and following
that's
up.
Right. That's right. Dr. Sack, have you had a chance to follow this story? And what do you think about the Penn State hire and the reaction of folks at Penn State? I know you spent some time with folks on the campus before.
Who was that to just respond? Is that you, Eric, or who was it?
That was Phil.
Phil, that was I can't say it any better. I think from a political point of view, and just in terms of what if you're at Penn State and you're in the administration, you would like to show that you talk about Notre Dame, they call it Fortress Notre Dame, meaning Fortress Notre Dame, but you don't penetrate that damn thing, and nobody knows anything that's going on outside Notre Dame from a public relations point of view. And that's the kind of thing that leads to a scandal like the Penn State one. So maybe Penn State saying, hey, look, we don't want to look like Fortress Penn State, especially now when they're under such scrutiny, and they want to show we're open to the open world. We're going to open ourselves up, and you can take a look in. So staying parochial and inside suggests, hey, we're going to associate ourselves too much with the former administration, the Joe Paterno group for all those years. It's time for a refreshing wind coming in from the outside. I think, is it Jim O'Brien? Is that his name? It's Jim O'Brien. Jim O'Brien from the Patriots. I read some stuff today where the quarterbacks out there are thinking this is pretty cool, you know, to be able to be coached by someone who's such a fine offensive coordinator for the New England Patriots. I think he'll win them over. He sounds to me like he's going to have a charismatic kind of personality. I think the athletes did meet with him, and generally there was now a more positive reaction. But of course, that's irrelevant if he loses. It's a Charlie White situation, you know. So whether he can win or not, that's another question.
Well, and I think one of the key things about, particularly with the Rich Rodriguez situation, that it wasn't just going away from a Michigan man, but they also went away from a Michigan style of play. They revamped the type of program, and they went into something that's different. I don't see this hire. It may be going away from a Penn State guy, but I don't know if it's going away from a Penn State philosophy in terms of how they play the game of football. And I think that's the one that I don't want. I hope people don't get, I guess, to kind of follow in terms of making the comparison with Rich Rodriguez. You went from a totally – with that hire, they threw the baby out with the bathwater. They threw everything out of it in terms of Michigan style and play that they're rebuilding right now. Penn State, I don't see that as what they're actually doing.
I don't see that either. I think they took that into consideration when they were making the hire. You're not going to a totally different kind of offense and just switching the whole philosophy. So I'm cautiously optimistic here that I think Penn State can make a real quick turnaround and just hang in there and continue being a winner. I'm very concerned, and I hate to pull this thing back to the previous issues we've been talking about, but I'm very concerned that we're going to forget about what happened at Penn State. We're going to forget that this was not simply a deviant act by a pedophile, and that could happen anywhere. This was a cover-up of a deviant act by a pedophile, by not only the coaching staff, but by the entire university, so that I perceive this thing as a national problem of big-time college sports taking over and actually intimidating the hell out of the university governance structure, rather than an egregious act, which is a isolated thing that took place in a locker room with sodomizing a young 10-year-old. So I just did want to make that point, that it's easy for us all to immediately go back to talking football and talking sports and are they going to win, blah, 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 and forgetting what happened there. And what happened there was not simply a deviant act. This is endemic to big-time college sports, that people on college campuses live in fear of allowing something negative to get out about their college football program or their athletic programs, so much so that they'll throw their academic values and standards and commitments and ethics under the bus in order to placate and in order to protect their athletic programs. That's the story I see coming out of Penn State, and it's not just a Penn State story. It's a big-time college sports story, and I hope that doesn't get lost as we go back. And I'm not criticizing the discussion we're having right now, because I love to talk about, is Penn State going to be able to come back from this? What kind of coach should they have? Are they going to win? That's an important issue. But that backdrop, you know, that I think we shouldn't forget about.
And I think in the way in which you laid that out is really a part of how we attack the funky editorial. We try to get that story behind the story, because that's something that we've been talking about, is who's in charge. And we know who's in charge. And how does that change even with this? Does that change? Are we masking it? And I think that is really the story, as you said, behind the story. And is that something that's going to still be in the forefront? And part of this hire was get us as far away from that as possible so that we can get back to the business of sports.
Yeah, and do any of you guys truly believe that there were not people on the Board of Governors and the Board of Trustees that knew about this at Penn State?
Oh, no. nothing happens without folks way up. Nothing happens without the folks at that level knowing about it.
Exactly.
We cannot be fooled.
So I
so
think
if we can get
point
the attention of the public away from that and get back onto sports and get, well, they did it. They went and played a game right after, you know, at the time, instead of taking a game off and kind of having some soul searching, then went right back to playing football. And I think that's what's going to happen here, where everybody's going to go back to playing football. And if that happens, we go back to the same problems that we have at the larger level.
Well, I think you're right on. And, Dr. Sack, we want to definitely thank you for contributing to our funky editorial. We hope that you will come back to our show, because I think we just hit the tip of the iceberg. And so hopefully we can extend an invitation to you as well. Please feel free to stay on as long as possible, but I know you have a busy schedule. But we definitely would love to have you come back.
Yeah, I'm going to have to run along, but I want to tell you guys that I've done hundreds of interviews, and I've never had a interviewers who are as well prepared as you guys are. You've got a great show going there, so terrific. Thank you for having me. I feel privileged to have been on your show, to tell you the truth.
Well, thank you, and we will definitely have you back, and have a great evening.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Well, we had that was Dr. Alan Sack. He fit right into RSG. We had a great time. He's right up in there. I love his attitude. And Eric, we want to give you a chance to even comment on this funky editorial as well. Hit us with how you feel about Penn State. But I'm just excited right now. I thought that was a great segment. But Eric, come in and give us your two cents on Penn State.
I thought it was a phenomenal discussion. Phil, you hit everything right on the head. Just one other piece that we may not have discussed is the difference, you know, being a Michigan guy, the difference between the Rodriguez move as opposed to this Penn State move is Michigan voluntarily went and got Rodriguez, a non-Michigan guy, knowing that he would change the schematics of what Michigan is about. Penn
That's
State
right.
didn't have a choice. This is something that they had to do. In order to get away from everything paternal, they had to make a move away from a Penn State guy. So that was my only two cents I wanted to bring in on that.
You hit it right on the head, and we're going to continue to monitor this story. That was our Resistance Digital Solutions, the funky editorial for us. Great topic to go on. We're going to move into five on the black-hand side to hit that with the web at five on the black-hand side.